If I were to ask you, who do you think will be the most influential person of the 21st century? Most of us would probably say, well, it's too early to tell. But if I were to ask you, who's the most influential person of the 20th century? We'd get answers all across the board. Because some of us would think in terms of some realms of influence others of us wouldn't think about. Some would think militarily. Great military leaders. It might be the most important person was Winston Churchill, or FDR, or Ronald Reagan, or any other presidents who were involved in wartime decisions that perhaps preserved what for us in our American culture is the freedom of our culture, maybe not thinking worldwide. Some of us would think educationally. We'd think who contributed the most in the 20th century to knowledge and the advancement of science or some other field. Some of us would think in terms of socially, who did great things in the world in the 20th century to bring about perhaps freedom or the lessening of oppression in different parts of the world? Maybe somebody who won a Nobel Peace Prize or somebody of that nature. We'd think of benefactors. People in medicine who made great advancements for all of us. Philosophers, people who advanced the mental capabilities of all of humanity. We'd come across with lots of different answers. And no one of us would be completely right because we would all come from a certain perspective. But I want to talk to you about the most influential person in the history of the world. What kind of person could be so influential in the world? What kind of man can split history into two parts? All of history reckoned from the point of this one person. If I could make that case for you today and convince you of that, we would certainly have found the most influential person in all the history of the world. Somebody said, we can gauge the size of a ship by the size of the wake it leaves behind it. You ever think about that? I mean, if you could tell a big ship has come by even if you didn't see the ship at all, just by the size of its wake. And I want to show you the kind of wake, because God clearly indicates that Jesus is the watershed of history. You know what a watershed is? It's a high point where all water goes off one side or the other. It's the highest point, the apex. Everything flows away from it. And I would suggest to you that that is where Jesus is. Let me make that case for you. First of all, Jesus split all of time into two parts. All of time. B.C. and A.D. B.C. means before Christ. A.D. doesn't mean after his death. A.D. is a Latin term, Anno Domini, which means after his birth. So all, and think about this, all of our reckoning of history is reckoned from the point Jesus came into the world. When you write a check or you sign and date a paper, you are recognizing the birth of Jesus. You're writing, if you were to write today, October 6th, 7th, yesterday, October 6th, if you wrote October 7th, 2018, you are saying today is reckoned 2018 years after the birth of Christ. Now think about how long that is. 2018 years, and we're still reckoning things from the birth of Christ. And everything prior to that. We say, and the country fell in 612, Nineveh fell in 612 BC, before Christ. And most of us never even think about that. We don't even think about the fact that every recognition we give about Jesus is in our dating of everything that we do. So we have this statement in Galatians chapter 4 and verse 4. And it says this: when the fullness of time came, Galatians 4, 4, when the fullness of time came, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law. The fullness of time. At exactly the right time, God sent His Son. And we all, consciously or unconsciously, recognize that moment as a pivotal one in history. When I think about the kingdoms of the world that have come and gone, and their reckoning is from the birth of Christ. How long before the birth of Christ was it? Now, you may say, well, but were they doing that before Jesus was born? I remember a guy who took a story about a guy who took a coin to a collector, and he said, hey, somebody wants to sell me this coin that they've had, and it looks really old. And he looked at the coin and he said, this is a fake. And he said, how do you know that? He says, because it's dated 312 BC. There's no way you could date a coin before Christ. We reckon time that way, but how did the ancients reckon time? How did they do that? What did their calendars look like? And I'm going to tell you, it's really interesting. Most civilizations have reckoned time in one of these ways. First of all, by celestial events. They would determine everything came in terms of celestial events. That was 12 years after the solar eclipse. Or that was 100 years after the coming of the comet. They would look at celestial events and they'd say, that's pretty significant. What just happened there? That was big. We will reckon that's a week after the comet, or 2 months after the comet, or 12 years after the comet, or the solar eclipse, or the lunar eclipse, or whatever it may have been. They reckon time by celestial events. Or they reckon them by cataclysmic events. 100 years after the earthquake. Now, you can understand those would have been pretty localized ways of reckoning time, because nobody across the world would have known about the earthquake that happened here, but that's the way they figured it. I was born in the 12th year of the volcano. The volcano exploded. 12 years later, I was born. That's how they reckoned it. And since everybody in that area knew about the volcano, they could figure out how long after the volcano you were. So they reckoned them by celestial events, cataclysmic events, or the reign of kings. That was the third way. So you have this statement in Isaiah chapter 6. In the 50th year of King Uzziah. So they reckon time from the reign of kings. I was born 12 years after the coronation of this king or this queen, or the death of this king or this queen. Now, what's really interesting is that God brings about all three of those concepts in Jesus. You've got a celestial event, the coming of the star. You've got a cataclysmic event in the reign of Herod and the destruction of the children in Bethlehem. That's cataclysmic. And you've got the reign of a king. A new king is born. This is the first year of his reign and of his kingship, or the declared birth of the king to come. You've got the wise men saying, there's born a king in Bethlehem. So it's kind of neat that God says, take all the ways you reckon time, I'm going to pull them all together and put them there for my son when he comes to this earth. And then They now, at the time, at the birth of Christ, they didn't start saying, okay, today's 1 AD or 30 AD. Jesus was crucified in 30 AD or 33 AD. So you say, well, how do we get the reckoning of time? Now, this is really interesting. To me, the Catholic Church was having trouble establishing uniform celebrations of certain events, particularly Easter. Some churches and some areas were celebrating it a week or a month earlier than others, and they wanted some kind of uniformity. So they had this monk in Italy named Dionysius, and he said, why don't we formalize all of our keeping of time, and we'll do it from the birth of Christ. So he calculated the year of Jesus' birth at 753 years after the founding of Rome. Now, the 753 doesn't matter to us. It's not like that's significant, but that's what he figured it was. Jesus was born 753 years after Rome was founded. And he called that 1 AD. And from that time, we reckon all time, from that moment, all time is reckoned by the birth of Christ. So the ancients and most moderns, without even acknowledging it publicly, are acknowledging the birth of Jesus as a pivotal moment. Now, some of the younger ones in this audience, and some of you who are older, are going to say, I never knew that, because I've never spoken on this, that some of the older people in the audience said, I've never heard that. But you need to know that the children are being taught in public schools particularly, but in universities, they no longer use the term B.C. and A.D. They use the term B.C.E. and C.E. How many of you are familiar with that? B.C.E. and C.E. The Common Era. That's what we live in. We're in the Common Era. So scientists and historians will not date today as 2018 AD. They will date it 2018 CE, Common Era. And everything in the past, way back in the past, before 2018, is the before the Common Era. Before the Common Era and the Common Era is separated by what event? The birth of Christ. If you were to ask a historian, tell me now, what happened that made it before the Common Era and the Common Era? If he answers honestly, he will say the birth of Jesus. And you're probably thinking, so then why did they change the nomenclature? You thinking that? So why did they change it? Because there are people who are offended by Christ. And they wanted to find some way to soften that for non-believers. So in their attempt to do that, though, it's like nobody wants to say the emperor has no clothes. But it's the same thing. So even when in school you say that happened 421 BCE, before the Common Era, you are still reckoning time, even though you don't say it, before Christ, you're still reckoning time that's 400 and something years before Christ came. Every calendar in the world, with the exception of the Islamic calendar, every calendar in the world acknowledges Jesus split time. His coming made all the difference between things that happened before Him and things that happened after Him. Can you imagine the influence that He wields by His very birth. Nobody else in the history of the world has ever done that. It's interesting that Louis the 14th or 15th was called the Sun King. And at the end of his life, made a statement about his passing saying, "After me, the deluge." In other words, after me, it all falls apart. And it didn't. But Jesus made that kind of difference. When He came, all of time was split into pre-Jesus and post-Jesus. Jesus splits covenants. Now, this one's a really important point for all of us who are in the Bible. If that first one was for everybody in the world, this is certainly for Bible believers. Have you ever thought about what made the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament? I was in a Bible study not too long ago in a meetup, and I was making the point that Jesus is offering in Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7 a contrast between what the old law said and what He Himself poses. You've heard it was said, but I say. You know, it was said, but I say. And He's making a contrast between what the old law said and what He said. And even to make sure people understood that, He said, you know, I didn't come to destroy the law, I came to fulfill it. But in fulfilling it, He comes to bring it to an end. And a young man who was in that meetup took exception to that and said, no, it's one Bible. From beginning to end, it's one Bible. And I said, well, that's both true and not true. I mean, it is true that it's one message from the same God. But what was given to the Old Testament faithfuls and what is given to people after that time is a different message. It's not radically different, but it's not the same message. We're not Jews. We are today followers of Jesus Christ. And Jesus made that distinction. By His life, He effectively, I don't want to say destroyed, because that makes it sound like He did away with it altogether. I believe the Old Testament. I believe it came from God. But it's not God's binding law for us today, because Jesus made that different. And He's the only one that could do that. So we have statements like this. Galatians chapter 3, if you'll turn there with me, and look at verse 19. And you may be asking, well, Ralph, given what you're saying, why was there ever a law? Why the law then? Good question. Paul asks it. It was added because of transgressions, having been ordained through angels by the agency of a mediator, until the seed would come to whom the promise had been made. And then verse 24 says, the law has become our tutor to lead us to Christ so that we may be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. The old law existed to bring us to a knowledge of who Jesus was. And then it handed us over to Him to say, here's the new law that has come. Here's the way we will follow God now. It's through the leadership of Jesus Christ. Old law, new law. It's said again in Hebrews chapter 1. And I pointed this out to the young man that was in that meetup with us. I said, listen to Hebrews chapter 1. Verses 1 and 2. God, after He spoke long ago to the fathers in the prophets, in many portions, and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in His Son, whom He appointed heir of all things, through whom also He made the world. And then you go over to chapter 8. Of Hebrews. And in verse 13 it says, when He said a new covenant, He has made the first obsolete. But whatever is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to disappear. In chapter 9, verse 15, for this reason, He is the mediator of a new covenant, so that since a death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were committed under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. And then in chapter 12, our last passage for this point, in chapter 12, beginning in verse 18, you have not come to a mountain that cannot be touched, that can be touched, and to a blazing fire, and to darkness and gloom and whirlwind, and to the blast of a trumpet, and the sound of words, which sound was such that those who heard begged that no further word be spoken to them. For they could not bear the command, if even a beast touches the mountain, it will be stoned. And so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I'm full of fear and trembling. Now all of that is describing the giving of the law at Sinai. All of that. The mountain, the trumpets, the trembling of the ground, the darkness, the fear of the people, and even the fear of Moses, all of that was, this is what happened when the first covenant was given. And that whole section starts with the words, you haven't come to that. That's not for you. And he goes on to say, you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to myriads of angels. Listen, if this were a movie, if there was a movie and there was a scoring of music for this little section, that first part would sound ominous because everything about that is frightening. But then when he says, but you've come to Mount Zion, all of a sudden the music would be beautiful strings and violins. It would be glorious music, because that's the contrast that the Hebrew writer is trying to set up. You didn't come to this, but to this. Not to fear, but to joy. Not to darkness, but to light. This is a new covenant. It doesn't look like the old one. It doesn't sound like the old one. It is not like the covenant that was given before. And he says, the general assembly, the church of the firstborn, who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood which speaks better than the blood of Abel. Jesus splits mankind into two parts. Mankind. Here's the point. Earl and Lane and I were talking yesterday about their daughter Sarah, who's moved to Alabama, and they were saying, and I know this, I have a nephew who lives in Alabama, and I've preached enough there. When you move to Alabama, you better make up your mind as to whether you're going to follow Alabama or Auburn. You better make up your mind, because you're going to be asked. And unless you just want to opt out of the whole thing, You got to pick. And there's no, well, I love Alabama and Auburn. There is no such thing. They'll put you away for that. But you got to make a decision. And we say about that, but there are neutrals. Yes, there are. And there are people who root for other teams besides those two. Yes, there are. And I want to tell you, Jesus has the audacity to say to us, you're either with me or you're against me. There's no neutrality. There are no Swiss in the spiritual world. You know what I mean? Swiss or neutrals. There are none. In the spiritual world, listen to Jesus. Listen to the wording He gives to this. Matthew chapter 12, verse 30. Matthew 12 and verse 30. Here's what Jesus says. He who is not with me is against me. And he who does not gather with me scatters. Jesus says, are you on my side? No, I'm not on anybody's side. Nope, can't be there. You're either with me. Are you with me? No, I'm not with you. Then you're against me. That's it. There's no option. There's no middle ground. There's nobody standing in the middle. It's either with me or you're against me. And if you're going to gather with me, that's good. But if you're not gathering with me, then you're on the opposite side. You're scattering. He does not make any option for people to be neutral. I said that this morning earlier when I was trying to make the point, you really don't have the option to ignore what Jesus is. We don't have that option. I think he's a good man. I like a lot of things he said, but I'm not really into following him. You know, you understand? I can do that with politicians. I can do that with statesmen. I can do that with people I know. I like them or don't like them, but I'm not with them. You can't do that with Jesus. You are either with him or he says, you're against me. In chapter 10 of Matthew. Listen to what he says in verses 32 through 38. Therefore, everyone who confesses me before men, I'll confess him before my Father who is in heaven. Whoever denies me before men, I will deny him also before my Father who is in heaven. Don't think I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be the members of his household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not, listen to this, take up his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who's found his life will lose it. He who's lost his life for my sake will find it. Here's the point. Jesus says, you want to follow me? Pick up your cross. We say, you know, I don't really want to follow, I don't really want to pick up the cross, but I'm not your enemy. Jesus says, no, you are. You're either with me or you're against me. He splits all of mankind into two camps. There's no third camp. You're either with him or you're against him. And so in 2 Thessalonians, we got this statement that God will, in chapter 1, verses 7 through 9, will deal out retribution to those who do not know or obey the Lord Jesus. That's two different groups of people, but they both are lost. If you don't know him and obey him, you're lost. Retribution of God will fall upon you. Who in the world besides Jesus has the audacity to say every person on earth will be judged by the way they respond to me? How you treat me, whether you obey me, is the determining factor for the entire world in judgment. That's Jesus. He splits mankind in two. The final thought for us, for me and for many people in this audience, Jesus split my history in two. Jesus split my history into two parts. Because I had a history before Christ. I had a life. I had a direction I was going. I had a place I was headed to. A status I desired to achieve. Before Christ, it was one thing. And after Christ, it is totally different for me. Totally different. My history is different because of Jesus. And the statement that really hammers that home for me is this beautiful statement with its concluding remark in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, beginning in verse 14. For the love of Christ controls us. Having concluded this, that one died for all, therefore all died. And he died for all so that they who live, listen to the contrast, so that they who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who died and rose again on their behalf. See the difference? See the split? They no longer live for themselves, they live for him. Therefore, from now on, we recognize no one according to the flesh. Even though we've known Christ according to the flesh, yet now we know him in this way no longer. Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creature. The old things passed away. Passed away. They've died. Behold, new things have come. That's the status of my life. Nobody. Look, my life is different since I married Paula. My life was different when I had one child, and when I had two daughters, and when I had three daughters. And my life is really different with grandchildren. But no one in my life has made the impact and the difference that Jesus Christ has made in my life. Every decision I make regarding my future has to take him into my confidence. I've got to make sure that's what he wants me to do. And that goes down to the daily decisions that I make. Is this what the Lord would want me to do? What does Jesus want from me? There's nobody that has that kind of impact on my life or on the life of any Christian. That's the way every Christian has to live, because that's what God has called us to in following Jesus. So when we talk about what kind of man can split history into two parts, there's only one I know of. What kind of man? It's a man who was God in the flesh, who split time, who split the covenants. My Bible is split into two parts by Jesus, who split mankind into two parts. We're for him or we're against him, and there's nobody in the middle ground. And who split my life into. There is nothing the same about my life now because Jesus is in it. And that is true for every child of God. That's not a preacher statement. That's not an older Christian statement or a dedicated Christian statement versus somebody else. That is true for every child of God. That's the Jesus that we're studying. That's not myth. Every time you write a check, you acknowledge his birth. Every time you state when you were born, you acknowledge, I was born on this date and this year, reckoned from the birth of Jesus Christ. Powerful man. Shaking the entire earth into the two parts that we know. If you want to give your life to anyone, give it to Jesus. Give it to Jesus. Come acknowledging him as the one who can split your former life away from you and direct you into the new life where all things are made new. We can help you do that. Now's the time for you to respond to the invitation to come follow Jesus with us. Come to the front while we stand and sing.